Never Have I Ever with Claire Byrne, a News Talk original podcast.
Sponsored by O'Brien's Wine. Conversation uncorked.
Poker is not about bluffing, it's about truth.
Never count your money as you're sitting at the table.
I got paid 100 grand to wear a hat once, you know.
I want to know how much you've won.
Well, I haven't had a job for 40 years.
Could you teach me how to play poker?
You can see the murderous money-craving sort of aspect,
what?
You know, which is there.
Never have I ever.
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 There are some things in life that I know I'm better off avoiding, not because I'm no good at them and not because I don't understand them, but because I think I know myself. I've been to Las Vegas a couple of times. I do know, I'll say vaguely, how to play poker. I even won on a roulette table once, but I don't think that counts in a poker conversation. That's almost worse though, isn't it, when you've won once, because it gives you just enough confidence to think that maybe it might happen again. And that's what worries me about this. I suspect that I would be a really terrible card player, always chasing my losses. That's what I worry about. And I think I'd always be convinced that the next hand would turn things around. But that's why gambling is heavily regulated, right? Why promotion and advertising around it are restricted, because it can and it does take over people's lives. And if I'm being really honest, while I'm curious about the world of professional poker and I'd love to know what it feels like to compete in a tournament, I also find it a little bit frightening. Like the windowless casino rooms, the tables filled with silent, concentrated faces, and behind it all, there is the risk of losing everything. And for some people, I know and I understand that that's thrilling, but for me, it's always felt a little bit dangerous, like something that you should maybe try to avoid. Never have I ever wagered serious money. But could I and should I? Andy Black has, and he joins me now. Andy, you're very welcome.
Nice to see you, Karen.
Does all of that sound familiar to you? Like all of those questions that I'm raising around the dilemma about this?
Well, oddly, I stand out amongst poker players in the sense that poker players regard me as very different, because I'm sort of, I suppose, famous for spending 5 years in a Buddhist monastery and then exploring the mind and stuff like fear, and then bringing those kind of skills to the poker table.
Okay.
So it made me both a bit of an outsider in two outsider worlds.
Well, let's go back then to when the cards started, or the desire to play or the interest in it. Where did that begin?
I always had an interest in probability and numbers, but actually emotionally it probably was egged on by the fact that I used to play my mother Heads Up 25, which I know you'd played and disliked.
No, I didn't.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what happened. It was played in my house. My
right.
father was really good at it, but he had all of these mad rules, which I accused him of changing all the time. It's the highest in red and the lowest in black, except when it's a jack, and I added on, and when it's raining on a Tuesday, because I felt as though the rules changed every time. But this was the thing. I never had the patience to sit down and learn those rules. I think that's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, look, I read that. I mean, I haven't spoken to you before, and I would have an assessment which is different than yours.
Right,
as
what
to
is
what's
it?
Going on. Well, no, I mean, maybe I should. Should I leave it? Yeah, I mean, because that's the bit that's most interesting to me. In terms of those kind of things or any kind of fear, I mean, the purpose of the whole series, I think people, I mean, you touched on it yourself, but they don't tend to look at themselves. They're moving forward. They're trying to become, as opposed to actually, well, what's actually happening? What's going on with myself? They're rushing to answer the question, or they're rushing to a conclusion. And usually the conclusion, for example, the conclusion that you had, you know, your father, for example, was maybe making up the rules. I mean, fundamentally, it sounded like you didn't fancy it.
Yeah, I'd say I just got frustrated. I'd made a decision that I wasn't going to be good at this thing, and that's a bit of a perfectionist trait,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, so as you're, because we're on radio, you know, one of the things I do all sorts of reading of people, yeah? And because we're on radio, you know, content is content. Everyone listening here, what Claire was doing was she was lifting up her right hand and she was moving it in a circular motion forward, yeah? So there was a sort of control thing going on there. So basically, you're not in control. So it's something you're not in control of. And you sense that pragmatically.
So you back away from it then.
Yeah, yeah. So and the question doesn't even arise. You're not actually looking at the fear at all.
Before we go any further, let me tell you a bit more about Andrew Black. Known in poker circles as the Monk, Andy is one of Ireland's most successful players, with close to $5 million in winnings over a career that has taken him from card games in Dublin to the biggest stages in Las Vegas. But poker is only part of his story. After years on the circuit, Andy stepped away from the game and spent several years living in a Buddhist community. These days, he also works as a coach, helping people understand how they think, how they make decisions, and sometimes how they get in their own way. And this feels like a particularly good moment to be talking about him. This episode lands in the middle of the 2026 World Series of Poker, the biggest event in the game. In fact, the main event begins tomorrow, and Andy will be among the thousands of players in Vegas hoping to become world champion. This is also the halfway point in our Never Have I Ever conversation. Today we're talking about poker, risk and money, but what I'm really interested in now is something else. How much of what stops us, stops me trying new things, is fear? And can somebody who spent a lifetime making decisions under pressure help me separate the genuine risks from the stories I tell myself? Let's come back to the poker, because are you ever in control when you're playing a poker game?
The nature of human existence is we're not in control, because we all get sick and old and die. So poker, arguably, is maybe just a more obvious example of that. That's all it is. And I think what we often do as humans is we look at the example of something which is seems less in control. Mm-hmm. And then the question we ask, it's too polarized, whereas it's a matter of degree. So you could break down the game of poker and say, compared to, for example, roulette, which is a pure gambling game, there are lots of odds in poker, but then there's a huge skill in navigating.
Okay. That. So you were born and raised in Belfast, isn't that right? And then came to Dublin to study law at Trinity. How did that go?
I was probably one of the great conditionings which I've been working on. So, you know, you have a lot of people coming on shows, you know, and they rose up from being maybe poor or all sorts of stuff, difficulties, et cetera, et cetera. But one subject that people rarely talk about is the people who come from the lawyer, doctor class, the sort of intellectual ruling class, yeah. And they have to actually unwind that type of conditioning.
That was you, was it?
Yes. So all my family are doctors, lawyers, very high up in that world. The only reason I studied law was because everyone thought I wasn't going to do well in my exams. And then I ended up doing well enough to get into Trinity. But I'd no interest in it. It was just an ego thing. And I spent the last 30, 40 years unwinding what I would regard as an arrogant conditioning, or attempting to do that. Mm-hmm. So in terms of, say, exploring things like fear, we each have to unwind or look at whatever our own conditioning is. So basically, I did that and I just wasn't interested.
And were you playing cards?
Within a couple of years. Yeah, within a couple of years, I was basically a professional card player, yeah. And I just discovered sort of people playing with chips. And then it was much more working class. So I was trying to, in a way, escape what I felt was the restriction of my own class. I no longer found it intellectually stimulating. And now looking back, I more clearly understand why that is.
What did your family think about? Did they know about this?
They didn't like it at all, you know. I mean, they were profoundly worried. It was only when I eventually made a million that they thought, oh, that's okay. Yeah, and in a way, it was 10 years of real struggle in Dublin at that time, where there wasn't a lot of money around, and it was real hand-to-mouth stuff, and it was grifter stuff, and it was much more working class.
And were there many poker players around, like serious poker players around?
Not that many.
You're meeting the same people all the time?
Yeah, you're meeting the same people all the time, and everyone has nicknames and stuff like that. My favourite nickname ever, or my favourite two nicknames, were a guy called Safety. He was a funny-looking lad. And, you know, I thought, oh, he must be a poker player, plays really carefully. But actually, He was a wild poker player. He was called Safety because he played safe at snooker. So it's kind of like, and then there was a guy called Doomsday Dez. And Doomsday, no matter how far ahead, no matter how likely he was to win a hand, he would always kind of moan. And then whenever the hand, a bit like triggering Only Fools and Horses, and then when the card came up that beat him, he'd go, yeah, I expected that.
You know? Always expecting the worst. Yeah, see, I have this impression of people playing poker around that you're not friendly, that you're not...
We are. It's like a club. It's like any of these things.
But you're trying to beat them. You're trying to take their money.
Yes, but that is the game. You know, I mean, footballers are friendly with each other.
I suppose,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, if you look, it's just because it feels quite alien. But actually, it's probably no different than anything else. I mean... For example, in here, maybe you're one of the more top dogs, but you still fraternize with the help, don't you?
Do you know the first thing I'll say about that is don't call them the help.
It's just to use a bit of humor there, you know. So there will be top dogs in poker, and then that's how you do that. You know,
the game is the game and the relationship is separate.
And then you'll have people who do act more arrogant. I've had times where I've been more arrogant and more disassociated. And then you have people who are naturally not so good at that and everything in between. Mm-hmm. But it's still a community because you share this common thing.
You know, some hurlers will say, oh, you're born a hurler or you're not. Is it the same with cards?
Question, right? So tell me why. However you view these things just depends on your existential position. Now that might sound a bit sort of heavy. Oh, what do you mean by that, right? So let's say, for example, you regard yourself as an atheist and you're just born and there's this life and then you're dead. Nature and nurture have completely different meanings to someone who imagines there's many, many lifetimes. So it depends. So you could say that there's nature, but what's your nature? What does that mean? That's a huge question, yeah? Then there's nurture, and then there's what I would describe as the mysterious unknown, you know, which everybody is the main part of everyone. That's the fundamental part of everybody. But the other stuff gets more press, you know, because we all talk about the other stuff, the known. But the real stuff, you know, if you look at whether it's love or wisdom or connection, it's kind of mysterious, isn't it? It's hard to put a finger on. But paradoxically, we seem to focus much more on stuff that feels tangible. But actually, if you focus too much on that kind of stuff, that creates a whole bevy of fears.
So are you telling me that poker players are made, not born?
Look, the hurling example, well, that might be understandable, you know, because if you've got generations of hurling players and that's the main thing, and it's you know, when you're a kid growing up and it's focused on, you know, I know kids in Kilkenny, you know, and it's very much like that. So it's a bit of everything. But here's the thing. There was a guy called David Hemery, and he did a survey. He did a book. He won the 1968 Olympic 400 meters hurdles in Mexico. And he was also the first winner of Superstars. You'd have to be probably about 50 or 60 my age, you know, which was a show on BBC where you did loads of different sports.
Yes.
Yeah? And he subsequently became the head of the British Athletic Association and was also the father of modern coaching theory. But early on in the 70s and 80s, he went around interviewing all of the top sports people in the world. From all the different sports. And in those days, no computers. He's traveling around and train to Russia to meet Bubka, you know. But he's meeting all these different... And he looked for the common factors that they had. And what it came down to, what they all had, was they weren't necessarily the most skillful, many of them. But they did have a self-awareness. They worked hard and they were present. So it was those three things. They could have been asshole. They may not have had a broad awareness, like someone like George Best, of broader things in the world. But they had a sense of who they were. They were present and they kind of worked hard. Mm-hmm. Their preparations were all different. Their ethical sensibilities were all different. But these were the three things which made them stand out.
And do you think that a poor poker player is a thrill seeker and a better poker player is somebody who is very cool, calm, into maths, you know, into the science of it? Or does it make a difference?
I think that's what you think, maybe.
It is what I think.
And I
think,
know, yeah.
But I think most people coming to this afresh would think that or have that
maybe,
question around it.
Maybe, but I think the better way to answer that, right, and is to ask you how you came to that conclusion, because I can give the answer because I'm not that person. So you're almost a better person for them to listen to than me. So if I ask you, how did you come to that conclusion?
I think, and I mean, I really am new to this. I know very little about the world that you know so much about. I think that if you're a thrill seeker, you're going to be chasing your losses and it's going to end badly for you. If you're sort of like very calm about it and very measured about it, and you understand it, you understand the odds very well, then you're probably going to come out of that with more in your pocket than the thrill seeker guy.
Yeah.
Is that it?
That's true.
That's how it works.
But it's interesting that part of your view about that, I think, is you wrongly identify yourself as being the kind of person who may lose your money. You're not looking at yourself honestly. You seem to me highly unlikely to be that kind of person. Yeah. If you were put in a poker situation and I said, okay, depending on how you do, the health of your children is going to be directly related to how you perform.
Things, doesn't it?
I think that might change things a bit, you know, so your fears may drop away. Fear often arises out of what you ignore, what you attach on to, or what you push away. So that is more the question for each of us. But we rush to a conclusion, and the conclusion says more about our own thinking than the subject. And my answer in some ways about how what I've done may well be not that useful to people, because each person has a different journey. But the honesty of being prepared to look at something is something which is rarely focused on. We're too busy going somewhere. So, I mean, the most simple teaching in relation to things like fear, which I think over the years when I've taught people or worked with people with this kind of stuff, and work with myself, yeah? So what we describe as fear, whether it's, whether you think, oh, I can I be a poker player, yeah? The fear that it develops into is a choice. You are making a choice. Now, the truth is the choice is so ingrained and so surrounded and so held in by your views and ideas and habits that it seems like it's not a choice.
Can you relate that back to poker for me? Are you talking about slowing play down and slowing reactions down at the table?
It's your mind. So what we do, so if people are listening, if you look at anything you do well, so it just so happens, at times I do poker well. You know, it's my 21st birthday, being the all-time winner in Ireland. So I'm 21 years waiting for someone to catch up with me, yeah? So you could argue I do that well. There's some people who do it better than me in the world, but I do that well. But what I do when I've talked to people about what they do well, it's the same thing. It doesn't matter what it is. But what they've done essentially is they've been present. So when you broadcast well, I can imagine, when you feel you've had a good broadcast, you essentially are present.
Yeah. It's single transferable skills.
Whether you can transfer it or not is another thing, because that can depend on, you know, the thing which you experienced when you were a kid, which you just didn't fancy that. and it's nothing to do with fears. And then later in life, you develop this odd idea, which is, maybe I'd be worried about losing money, which is the opposite of who you are, as far as I can gather. So that essentially divorces you from looking at it honestly.
You brought up money now. I want to know how much you've won.
Over the years?
Yeah.
Well, I haven't had a job for 40 years.
So this has been it.
Yeah, this has been it, yeah. This is the only way I've made an income. I mean, I've had this and that sponsorship and stuff like that. I got paid $100,000 to wear a hat once, you know.
Nice.
But those were the golden days of poker back around 2005. Yeah, it's...
Millions?
Well, I don't know. What did I spend in the last 40 years?
And that's the thing, isn't it? You got to work that bit out.
Yeah, it must be. I suppose it must be. Millions, yeah, I guess it must be, yeah. I have actually been plagued. Another reason why I've explored this stuff is I've been plagued with profound difficulties in terms of trying to focus and being distracted and letting negative emotions cloud me and blacking out. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, when I used to debate fairly at a high level when I was in university, and at times I would just black out.
Why?
In the middle of a debate. Well, it's hard to say, but I've tracked it back to there was something about a non-engagement in my own family. And essentially, I was trying to be like them. You know, I was trying to be this professional,
detached person.
And yeah, there was a certain emotion which was not engaged with in my own family, and a certain interest in truth. There was more a sense of being in charge. And I wasn't going that way. And I think part of me shut down.
Did that happen to you in poker games?
And it happened to me. I mean, yeah, I mean, I was very famous for being the guy who lost it more than anyone else.
I became Tell world me about famous. That.
No, I became world famous. There was one guy, a guy called Mike the Mouth, and he was the most famous. Maybe he still is, but there was a period where I almost overtook him, certainly in terms of the amount. So basically, the biggest win I had, I nearly won the world championship a couple of times, but I was fifth once in it, and I got like 1.75 million. But the first prize was 7 million, and it would have been worth another 10 million, I'd say, in various other things.
Deals off the back
so
of it.
Promotions, yeah. And various things like that. But basically, I had it won. I had most of the chips. And then my mind went. Yeah. And I played worse than you would play. Right. Worse than anyone would play. And this happened again and again.
How do you recover from that? I don't know. Do you just replay the moment where it went wrong again and again? Do you beat yourself
well,
up?
Well, people's recovery, I mean, I know all the principles for recovery, but everyone's recovery is different.
Yeah.
But the first thing I would say to anyone listening to this is you need to decide that you want to recover, and you will keep exploring and looking and see what works. Most people who teach and help people with this stuff, or if I was only to talk about what I did, people then try and copy someone else. But everyone's a bit unique. But there are principles which are definitely the same. You must be prepared to look at yourself and lose it and fail and then look again and then look again, because it's a bit like we're an onion and you keep, you know, on peeling layers of bullshit that you add on. So the bottom line is most people do not want to look at their shit, and they also want to remain in charge. So we keep reforming. We keep... Even if the particular danger is when you make progress, right? Let's say a lot of people who teach this stuff or do this stuff, they make progress and then, you feel good. Yeah, you know, I've gone to that yoga class. I've done that. I had that conversation. I did that therapy. And then that's the most dangerous time, because what you do then is you then reform your identity, and that becomes you rather than you seeing that you've made a journey. But it's the making of the journey which you have to keep doing. And the tendency to settle down is probably most dangerous when you make progress and most difficult when you are suffering the most.
So have you accepted those losses, the difference between 1.75 million and 7 million and the other 10?
I would say that this is something that's very difficult to describe, but I'll put it to you like this. Let's say there's some non-acceptance there, but that non-acceptance is there for me in everything. So sometimes, say, if you look at someone in politics, or you do politics, and let's say you don't like Trump or you don't like Joe Biden, yeah? So you're in one of those two camps, right? And you look and you see that guy is full of hate, or that guy is detached from reality, yeah? And you can see that. You can see, oh yeah, that person, he's like that. Well, what we do in practice is we actually, we use that as a method to actually not continue to look at ourselves. We find a way to either...
You're focused on hating the other guy.
Yes.
So regretting the loss and not getting over it is self-destructive.
What I'm trying to say is even if I have some regret or some lack of acceptance, it actually is everywhere in me. Do you see what I mean?
See, yeah.
So people tend to think that guy is more hateful than me. But the bigger issue is hate, even if it's like a drop of ink, it's like a drop of ink in water. what's the difference between if you put a drop of ink in water and it's kind of a bit red ink and it's a bit red, and then you put loads of red ink in there?
None.
And I think that is the type of way of thinking about it that I rarely hear discussed. It's more about comparing yourself, you know, favorably or unfavorably or the same to other people, rather than thinking, wait a second, how on earth do I get rid of hate?
So, Andy, when you decided to walk away, didn't you? You took a few years away from
that
world.
5 years. I was kind of burnt out. I was a bit lost. You know, poker was tough in Ireland at the time. But I always had a sort of tendency of there was something else. And I hadn't found a kind of religious path. And then I stumbled into a kind of meditation class. A girlfriend at the time was doing yoga. And on the top of the leaflet was, there are no higher teachings, only deeper understandings.
You were hooked.
And I went, I don't know what that means, but I'm hooked. But I'd never done anything like that. And I went in and I sat down. And again, a lot of people might relate to this. But I sat down and we lay down and did a body awareness meditation. And the moment I did it, I realized just by bringing your awareness to your body, your mind changed. As simple as that. So in a way, if I was talking to anyone, it would be like, okay, forget about sorting out. Just feel your physical sense, feel your sense of aliveness, and then go from there. So I did that, and then I found myself in a monastery sort of, and that was amazing. And I was on the verge.
Now, this is a big leap from seeing something on a leaflet to going to a monastery. And that was it for years, really, was it?
Yeah, 5 years, 5 years.
Incredible.
So it took me about a couple of years to get there, but I just built it up slowly. And what you're essentially doing, or what I was trying to do, is there was the ordinary thinking and the ordinary world, the busyness of life. You know, I was a poker player. And then what you could describe is we're a bit like glaciers, you know? There was this profoundly just as interesting unknown bit underneath. And I just went, oh, right, I think I'll go and explore that. That sounds quite interesting. And I realized I was a Buddhist. I put that in a certain way because the Buddhist teaching, again, is presented wrongly by nearly everybody.
You were a Buddhist?
I realized I was a Buddhist. So it was.
But are you a Buddhist now?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But you didn't reject the world of poker?
I did for 5 years, pretty much, yeah.
But not now. I mean, you're not...
That's another huge subject, because trying to integrate the two of those or justify that, because as a Buddhist, you know, I, let's say, I believe in things like non-hatred, non-violence, etc., etc. But yet, here I am doing something which ostensibly... So I've had a whole journey with that. I feel I have a peace with it and have for maybe 5 or 10 years. As again, each bit of me that hasn't been looked at affects everything because I can't unsee things. So until I have completely let go of hatred, it's almost like it's there. I mean, I got to a point where I had, you could say, a year or two with hardly a negative mental thought. And it was like, oh, great, oh, I'm like amazing, you know, and I'm teaching these people and doing this and doing that. And I'm like the dog's bollocks, yeah? And then everything came back.
Do you know why?
I think I know now why. I think it's because of what we're talking about, is that I was attached on to the experience, however positive, and therefore I was no longer present, you know? So this is the dance. You know, this is the danger in terms of if you get a teacher or if you look at yourself, there's as much danger in making progress as not.
I want to ask you about gambling. I've spoken to a lot of people, former gamblers, I would probably describe them as, who have been through, you know, awful life experiences. And I remember one time listening to an ad for a big gambling company on the radio. Somebody was with me who was a public health nurse, and she said, I will have to go into houses this week where children haven't had their dinner because of that company. Do you think that poker fits into that world? Do you see it as being part of that problem?
It's less part of the problem than the other stuff. I mean, one of the worst bits of gambling is the lottery cards. It's a bad bet.
The scratch cards?
Yeah, the scratch cards. Yeah, it's mostly working class people buy them way more. the odds of winning are crappy. You know, then you've got kind of, you know, it's manipulation, how they get people to bet. If you understand betting, you understand the exactly what the manipulation was. I actually applied to be on the UK Gambling Commission Advisory Committee. They created a bunch of people who were affected by gambling. I said, well, look, I'm actually an expert in it. And yeah, I've also been affected by it because it's been really tough for me sometimes. But I understand how the industry works. Why don't you put someone like me on the advisory committee? But they only wanted the people who were affected. And the problem was they didn't know how the whole thing worked. So they had no one there. The same is going to happen. I know what's happening in terms of gambling legislation in this country.
Yes.
And they're not bringing in anyone who knows anything about it. You know, our experience as poker players is it's almost like our game is in the middle of these casinos with all of these people rather mindlessly playing their roulette or whatever it is. But we're there thinking away, using our skill, trying to do well. An awful lot of people play poker as a social thing. So rather than spending money on something else, they enjoy playing poker.
In person. But when it went online in the early 2000s, it was more democratized. So more people could access it, including the people who didn't really understand it, I would argue, you know, yeah. And who were throwing a bit of money at it to see what would happen. That's the danger zone, is it?
It is, and I don't have the best answer for you. I don't think it's as bad as the other stuff, but it doesn't mean it isn't damaging. I mean, I've grappled with this my whole life, but it's a bit like every footballer who plays football, how many of them succeed, how many of them fail? They give up opportunities for education, or maybe their hopes and dreams are put in it, and then it doesn't work out. So these are complex questions, so it's not black and white. I struggle to have a clear answer. Should you? Yeah, I think the start of it is that people who are talking about it are from, it's like there's a lobbying group from boys like Paddy Power, yeah? And there's a bunch of government people who have no clue what they're talking about. And then there's people who've been hurt and affected. They're not bringing in the people, which I think happens in many of the industries, whether it's the health or education, who say, okay, how does this work? What exactly is happening?
You understand the nuts and bolts of it, yeah.
And this happens across the board.
With you in poker now, are you still playing? Are you still, yeah. Are you still chasing the big one?
Well, that's happening now in a couple of weeks. So, yeah. I don't play so much, and I've other things. I mean, I explore more. I do more coaching.
Poker coaching, or just more general stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's more general. Even the people I coach at poker, so nearly all the poker coaches coach mathematics, because supercomputers have come in, and it's all about the answer is there, and you find the answer and you do the answer. But then there's a whole how people are thing. So I work with people in poker and then outside, because my only interest is how people can be better themselves.
Could you teach me how to play poker?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually thinking, if one ever did that, how you would do that. I thought the way to do it was people couldn't recognize you. Yeah, so we'd have to dress
disguise
you up.
Me.
Disguise you, but then somehow you keep your personality. We change your name, call you C. I could teach you how to actually put the chips out, hold the cards, right? And then what would be fascinating in terms of trying something that you don't do, you get the more pure experience of trying to look and see when you're winning and losing, and trying to learn by watching what other people do.
Never count your money as you're sitting at the table, all that stuff.
Well, actually, I was doing a consultant for Fair City there recently. You know, they asked me to come in and consult just on, they had a poker game on one of the episodes. And what you find is that actually people then are sitting looking at their cards, yeah? But for a poker player, it's not your cards, it's your chips or everything. Your chips are your family. So I was coaching them to have a relationship with their chips.
Oh, I thought I'd have to just not care what the chips were and that I'd have to focus on the cards.
No, okay. You have a relationship with your chips. So your chips, that's your currency, yeah? So it's paradoxical. You need to think of the chips as illustrating what you think is demonstrating what your best decision is. So you need to care about the chips, but you need to then be, in a sense, quite cool, not distracted by your emotions and your fears.
Do you wear sunglasses when you play?
Occasionally, yeah. It depends.
Because I think I'd pick up my cards and my face would just tell everything. I'd be like, oh, great. I'd smile if I had a good hand and people would know. So do you have to train your face not to react?
Yeah, I'd have to look at you and see what you do. So let's say you've got a very good hand. So you get a very good hand now.
How do I keep the smile off my face? I'd have a little grin. I'd have a little trying to control the smile coming.
Just imagine, you know, your chips.
Yeah.
You can do it. So imagine your chips as your children's welfare. Yeah. Now.
Okay, now look at my cards.
Now, there's not a hint of emotion here. You're not, you see, this.
No, I have a bit of a smile.
No. It was cold. That was cold-blooded. You'll be fine.
I'm teachable.
Yeah.
And when, I'm sure you've done this, like that, you know that move you see on the telly where you push all the chips out into the middle of the table? What does that feel like? All in.
I don't do that. Very few people do that.
Oh, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
It's just the movies, isn't it?
So just to understand, one thing about poker, right? I tried to get them to do proper hands in that episode, but they already had a pre-idea. You couldn't change the script. So I'd written a wonderful little change of script for them. They didn't tell me not to do it, which would make the hands, say, on Fair City be interesting. All the hands everyone sees in Casino Royale or Rounders, et cetera, all the major poker movies, it's all one big hand against another, four of a kind, against a straight flush. And everyone puts all their money in, pushes all the chips in. Here's the reality of poker. The skill in poker is, let's say there's a hand ranking from 1 to 100. When your hand ranking is 62 and someone else is 61, you get as much money out of them as possible. When your hand is 63 in the ranking and someone else's hand ranking is 64, you lose as little money as possible. So a lot of poker comes down to
slim margins.
Slim margins. But through your understanding, experience, reading abilities, it's profoundly detailed. You realize, okay, this is my skill. The other example, because people ask me a lot, oh, is it all about bluffing? Poker is not about bluffing. It's about truth. It's the opposite. So you're trying to discover the truth of what's happening, what's going on with the other person, their strength. Right?
So what are you doing?
As we're sitting here, just it's for the audience, Claire has gone back in her seat, right? Which is a sort of classic, I'm being careful, yeah? Her finger, middle finger is up against her lips and her hair, chin is slightly tilted forward. So you can see the murderous, money-craving sort of aspect.
What?
You know, which is there, sort of in there, which we haven't explored. You can see the learning machine at work.
Can I tell you what I was thinking as you were saying that? How are you reading another, let's call them professional poker player? How are you learning their truth?
Yeah, so that was the learning. So you're learning. So yeah, so there was so you're wondering about that, yeah? You're trying to understand that. The manner, so let's say there's all sorts of different, the position you sit at the table, the amount of chips you have, the tendencies of that particular professional, because people aren't human, they're all different. What they're like at that given time, what they're like at that moment in the tournament, and then there's other stuff. There's subtle body language. So it's a bit of a lost art, but it's something I explored profoundly. And basically, I'll give you a good one, which not a lot of people know, right? So there's all sorts of body language. When you lean back, you're fairly tight. When you move forward, you're looser, you know? If you kind of glance and look away at the cards, it's tight. If you stay there, then it's more loose, yeah? But here's one that's really interesting, which very few people will have ever heard of. And people might know this if ever you've wondered whether your partner's unfaithful. You know, people, if you think about this, right? So somebody's at the table. I'm a bit of a master at getting people to talk. So I'll sit there for a minute or so, and then I'll go, oh, fucking weather's bad today. Yeah? And that might loosen them up, and they might say something. And if I can get them to say a sentence, oh, how are you doing? Do you feel it? Is that a strong hand you have? Or, you know, so if I can get them to say anything, if what they say is kind of logical and in line and makes sense, then they're probably not bluffing. But if you feel that it's slightly off, it just doesn't align with, you know, so where were you last night? Oh, I was out, the lads are playing snooker, but yeah, he doesn't play snooker, you know. Or maybe his voice is a bit raised, but if it's slightly different that and less cohesive, then frequently that's bluffing.
Interesting. So the mind is elsewhere. The mind is not on what they're saying to you. It's on what's in their hand.
Well, they can't. Who we are is, you know, the idea of being holistic. So hitting on the same thing to do with fear or anger. Whatever we have, which is getting in the way or revealing of what we are, is very difficult to disguise. So what I was very good at, which is even subtler, which is a sense of energy. So let's say everyone has to put in the chips. Let's say somebody moves their hand at 3 miles an hour, and then another guy moves his hand at
he's jaunty.
3.2 miles an hour, right? And this is the professional poker player. So there's a very famous hand I played against. He's known as the Tiger Woods of poker, just near the end of the World Championship. And he was regarded as the best poker player in the world. So it still has credit for that, maybe, in some ways. And we played a very famous hand where neither of us had anything. And it was raise, re-raise, re-raise, re-raise. And it wasn't the straight flush. You know, I had nothing and he had nothing. But I felt that the way, at one point he asked me a question. He went, how much? Now, he knew how much. And I was sitting there under intense, you know, at the moment, I think at the time I was guaranteed like $500,000. But if I got this decision right, I shoot at 7. If I get it wrong, that's it, yeah? And there's huge crowds and there's all the ESPN and all the rest of it. But I was sitting there going, what does it mean, him saying, how much to me? It feels not quite right. Now, the difference between someone who's a real poker player and someone who isn't is I'm prepared to get behind that. So many people need to wait for certainty. But then when you look at it, what is certainty? You know, if you decide to choose who your husband is going to be, are you certain? What is certainty? You know, if you really look into it and try and find certainty, you cannot find it anywhere.
So you had to back the feeling that you had around him asking you that question
at
that time.
It's just a particular type of focus of doing that. But over the years when I've looked at it, people talk about things like certainty. But when you examine, it's a bit like a quantum physicist examining sort of atoms in the universe, and you keep finding the smaller bits. When you examine what you think of as certainty or what you think of as fear, what you find when you really look, you know what you find? Nothing. And I don't mean nothing as a blank. I mean no thing. It's not a real thing. But we make it into something that is real. And then we talk to other people about how you're doing with it. But very few people understand that actually fundamentally it's concocted. We've contrived it.
Do you have a never have I ever? Have you anything that you have never done that you would like to try or something that you would never do because the barriers are just too great?
No.
No fear.
I wouldn't say I have no fear, but when you ask that question, I'm left with no.
There is
if somebody put a gun to my head, it wouldn't bother me.
Has that ever happened?
No, but I know people it's happened too. And certain things have happened like that. It's almost like I get a bit more focused. But in a way, that's neither here nor there. I don't think so. But then that being said, I have been fearful of the smallest things. You know, in recent times, there's some I could say, but I can't say them because they're personal and might affect other people. But I can think of, I was thinking on the way in here, yes. But the reason for that is because I haven't quite completely let go fear, which is possible, where you're not fearful of anything.
It's a work in progress.
I know I'm close, but it's a bit like a path. And every once in a while, I wander off into the jungle and get completely lost, you know.
Andy Black, thank you so much for being with us. Great to meet you.
Yeah, I didn't feel any fear there at all.
You You've been listening to Never Have I Ever with me, Claire Byrne. You'll find a new episode every Wednesday morning on the Go Loud app or wherever you stream your content. Please be sure to like and follow the podcast or leave a review. We love your feedback. You can also email me at any time. The address is never@newstalk.com. Never Have I Ever is a weekly podcast from Newstalk. The producer is Tom Donnelly. And don't forget, you'll find the Claire Byrne Show every weekday morning from 9, live on Newstalk Radio and streaming on the Go Loud app.
Never Have I Ever with Claire Byrne, a Newstalk original podcast.
Sponsored by O'Brien's Wine. Pour your heart out.